My name is Gary Butterfield, he, him.
My name is Kay Ross, she, her.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs Dispatch, our monthly Q&A topics, listener response, announcement-y episode.
Yeah. We are here. This is a little bit out of sequence to accommodate my move. We swapped the premium episode and the dispatch episode this month. You know, just way she goes.
Yeah, I would be surprised if somebody was very invested in when the dispatch comes out.
Yeah, no, that'd be a really, it'd be weird if you were more invested in that than we were.
Yeah, it'd be a strange thing to do. It's okay. It's harmless. We're not mad about it. It would just be strange, I think.
Yes.
Objectively a little strange. So we're going to answer your questions here and read your responses to February's games. I'm going to start here with Max. Max says, what's the most scared you've ever been playing a video game? When I was in middle school playing Diablo, the various Tristram residents telling me about the Butcher had me extremely reluctant to fight him. The first time I found myself outside his chamber, my mouse hand was shaking uncontrollably. When I opened the door, saw the Butcher and his menagerie of corpses, I heard the words, ah, fresh meat. I immediately reloaded the game because I just wanted him the fuck off my screen. I eventually got past him, but the buildup and reveal made it a particularly memorable gaming experience.
Yes. I feel like we just did a topic about this, but we can repeat ourselves, or maybe we give a different answer because we don't remember what we said.
Yeah.
Like mine wasn't like a specific thing that really like got me like, oh shit, like this particular thing is indelible in my memory. I think it's just at a certain point playing Silent Hill 3, like very specifically when you get to the, when you get to like the beginning stretch of the amusement park, kind of toward the end, basically everything up through the funhouse, kind of fake out scare kind of stuff, that all was just so overwhelming to me that I had to like go be in a different room for a while.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting the way that scariness finds your weakness of things. Like I historically have never found Silent Hill games scary.
Uh-huh.
Like they don't hit that thing for me. Like they're interesting. Like I am engaged in them and they have concepts I think are scary, but I've never felt a visceral fear.
Okay.
From the Silent Hill universe. Like I think that my stock answer of what I said last time was probably the Half-Life mod Afraid of Monsters.
Okay.
Which scared me a lot when I played it. The another answer would be the first time you go in the basement in Resident Evil 7.
Yeah,
I find that very scary.
Yeah.
Until you realize like when you go into a door and you leave, they just dissolve. Like you can very comically make them dissolve and reform like a billion times and it kind of takes the fear out of it. Uh-huh. But the first time, very scary.
Yes. Yeah.
For Gary's.
Love a good scary moment. This could have been a lightning round, but I'm going to put it in the games question here. Videogames.Afghanistan says, why do I love Amaze in real life, but hate them in games?
Because they're obvious padding in games.
Yeah.
It's busy work.
You're not going to encounter a maze in between you and something you are trying to accomplish that's mission critical in real life. A maze is something you have to go to as like a fun activity or diversion.
It's an event.
Yeah.
You're there for the maze. In a video game, it is just there to stop you from getting to the thing you actually want to do.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an obstacle versus an activity. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. I also think rarity is an issue.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to mazes in real life with the frequency in which they show up in video games? Like that's crazy.
If you're encountering them in your day, like in your day-to-day life, I really need to know where you live.
Like you're imagining them. Like they're not, I don't think they're real in that case. I don't think you can encounter them with that frequency.
Yeah.
Like they only really have them one time a year and they're all made of corn. It's by nature very temporary.
Yeah, and also like not that strong. Like you can just pick a direction and walk. Like you can get between corn stalks. It's really like a gentleman's agreement that the corn maze is honored.
Yeah, we agree that this is a wall. Like we both know it isn't a wall, but we agree that it's a wall. It's a mime wall. It's a mummer's wall.
Yeah.
So I think that's basically why. I hate a maze in a game if it doesn't have a way around it. Like sometimes the best mazes have a puzzle. They're a puzzle.
Yeah.
They're not really a maze. I've only done real life ones a couple of times. I can't say I love them. Mm-hmm. It's okay. You know, I've done some corn mazes. I've done a couple like, those little ground labyrinths that are not mazes.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But you just kind of, again, it's a gentleman's agreement. You just pretend.
Contemplative. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's okay. I don't know. I've never loved it. There is a golf, but it's not as wide for me.
I like it. It is like, I get anxious when I'm lost. So it is like a safe way to kind of engage with that anxiety for me, you know? Yeah. No. We talked about all this in the Mr. Maze episode of Abject Suffering. Yeah, if you want to hear Maze more.
Master.
Yeah.
Holland asks, what's your ideal number of entries in a video game series before buttoning it up and moving on creatively? I feel like movies is easily one, but with games, I feel like two is maybe the sweet spot. One to try the idea and two to iron out any kinks. Thoughts?
I think I pretty much agree with two.
Yeah, two is nice. Mm-hmm. There are so many series I like that have more than two.
Same. Yeah.
You know, but those are exceptions.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yeah, the biggest exception that would prove me to be a hypocrite on that is Resident Evil, but that is broken up into trilogies.
Yeah.
You know? So
Resident Evil, Silent Hill.
Yeah.
As well.
Baldur's
Gate. But again, that's barely connected. I guess what makes a sequel matters less than it used to back when a sequel was regularly more iterative. We're far away from the Mega Man days.
Yeah.
You know, of a sequel just being more of the same. Now, a sequel doesn't have to necessarily mean anything.
Yeah.
The way it used to.
Yeah. I feel like the last time a sequel was treated as a meaningful distinction was BioShock 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was held against it in a big bad way.
Yeah. So it's things have changed, you know, tables have turned a little bit.
Yeah.
There is a feeling of two being a proper number for things I really love, like in terms of like I am dining on Monster Train 2 and the new DLC and stuff. Mm-hmm. If they do a third one and it's just new clans and stuff, like I will gladly play it, but I would be surprised if they do.
Yeah.
You know, it does feel a little bit like they've done it.
Yeah. Go on to new challenges. Let somebody else pick up that particular corner of the roguelike space, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see here. Micah says, hey, y'all. For several years now, I have had consistent dreams of a fifth secret Majora's Mask dungeon beneath Clock Town, an upside-down ziggurat in a void of green light. It is so vivid to me that I often find myself forgetting it isn't actually real. Not sure where it comes from, but maybe it has to do with childhood memories of trying in vain to access fake, quote, secret areas in Zelda, Pokemon, and Minecraft that I either saw on YouTube or a friend just made up. Or later memories of wandering the most secluded reaches of my hometown in search of abandoned secret buildings as a teenager, before any of my friends had a car. Do y'all have any notable experiences with fake secret areas in games or real life? Also, how do I start dreamwalking?
I would Google that.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do it.
Yeah. I'm not an expert in the subject, nor have I professed to be.
I don't think I really want to.
Yeah.
For me personally, my imagination is such that I feel like my mind would betray me. I'd think that I was doing cool stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be like, I'm on a holodeck. And then at some point my mind would just be like, oh, hey, there's your mom. Mm-hmm. And it would just get really sad and weird. I don't trust my dream brain at all.
No. The limiter's off on it.
Yeah. I remember hearing about these, but the time in which I was in the pocket for these as a playground kid, they weren't, I feel like maybe not even not as common. I didn't get them as much though. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember hearing about getting, the truck in Pokemon.
Yeah.
You know, they could take you somewhere and get you a hidden Pokemon, things like that. But I remember even by the time I heard about that, it felt pretty fake. Mm-hmm. I got in the EGM, April Fool's Day, magazine things. Did a lot to erode my trust in terms of secret zones.
Yeah. I can think of, you know, in Final Fantasy VII, all of the Aeris rumors involved getting behind that one fish statue, you know? And I was oh man, maybe there's a big, Lost City, themed dungeon behind there. And that's what you have to get through, different versions in the telling. Because I'm younger, I was totally invested in the Pokemon Secret Truck. kind of deal. I think my version of it wasn't that the truck was going to take you somewhere. It was that the truck would move and there was a stairway there that took you to a dungeon. I believe very specifically where you could get Meryl.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Because like that was one of the handful of, Pokemon that was like previewed for Gold and Silver at the time.
Yeah. Pika Blue.
Yeah.
As it was known at the time. And think about what you missed out on. There's so many Zubats you could have fought every couple steps.
I know, right?
Pokemon Gen 1 Dungeon is the kind of that ages like wine.
It keeps me up at night. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It would be great. Uh-huh. So I don't have a good answer. But yeah, I think both of our answers is basically the Pokemon one.
Yeah. So like sometimes to put myself to sleep, I will in my mind just walk through old familiar locations, you know, like my old middle school or something like that. In times when I have walked around EverQuest locations, sometimes there has been like a dungeon underneath Freeport or something like that, you know. That is one of the things. But as like you are consciously walking through those places and then dream mind takes over and it spirals out, that is kind of neat.
Chris asks, question for Gary, on Everything to Golgari, Will mentioned he's more of a Netrunner guy. Did you ever play it? How did you like it? Are there any other TCGs, i.e. sorcery, or LCGs, i.e. Arkham Horror, that you've been curious about or given a try? I don't think Will actually is a Netrunner guy. I think he might have just been pulling that as an example of a card game.
Yeah.
To put against it. Will is very much an Arkham Horror guy. And I have also played, I was current on that up to a certain point. During the pandemic, I had a standing date with my friend Levi to go across the street and play through Arkham Horror. It was really fun. Me and Liv have got a set and played through some of it, but have not gotten a chance to play as much as we like. I have not played Netrunner. I know I would like it. The closest thing I played to that is the Shadowrun living card game, which was really fun. I would guarantee I would like Netrunner. I just have not given a chance. I love living card games.
Yeah. Netrunner is like super deep, isn't it? Like,
some
people, that's like most of what they play is Netrunner.
I think it's largely the Waypoint coterie.
It's
an Austin Walker. I think you're maybe getting that from Austin Walker being into it.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah. The person who I've seen talk about it the most, non-derogatorily, like it, by all accounts, it's real good.
You know what? It was a big Idle Thumbs thing too, actually.
There we go.
Yeah.
It's big for podcasters. It's not necessarily big for Gen Pop.
Right. So I'm just, I have a distorted view of it.
Yeah. Everyone on the radio is talking about this card game. But yeah, into Arkham Horror, Will's into Arkham Horror. I could be wrong about Will being a Netrunner. He's never talked to me about it before. But yeah, I'm into that whole world.
Yeah.
In terms of other trading card games, I pretty much played Pokemon for a little bit when it came out and played Magic and Spellfire for a little bit. But I have never gotten into sorcery, or I've heard of Flesh and Blood is really good. These are all things I'm interested in. I just don't really have a lifestyle for it right now.
Yeah. I played the Dragon Ball Z card game back sixth grade.
Is that just like a regular card game, but they add like six zeros to every number?
Actually, kinda.
Yeah.
And like, not there's just,
Yu-Gi-Oh does that as well.
Yeah. And there was also it builds like stalling. It builds in like building up your power level into it. Like each card, like you invest turns in raising the power level before you attack, if I remember correctly.
I love to not take turns in a game.
I know, right?
It's sick.
I don't remember it being very good. I think that one just quickly became, if I see a pack of these in the store as a little kid, I'll use my fun money on it, just because I wanted cards with Dragon Ball Z characters on them.
Yeah, I haven't actually even heard of that one. I was pretty. This probably came a little bit after my trading card time, because I used to get InQuest magazine, which had trading card games, and I have a bunch of old ones. Those are valuable now. Getting lots of those are more expensive than I like on eBay. But the most fun part was in the Magic the Gathering boom, they made tons of trading card games for many themes you may not expect. And none of them were good, but I loved reading about them. There's like a Gangland one that's just like mobsters that's supposed to be really shitty. There's one about baseball. they did everything at the time. Famously, SimCity, there's a comic book store in Portland, Oregon right now where I can go buy a booster box of the SimCity collectible card game if I want to.
Yeah.
We'll have to go there at some point. Future Dreams over on Burnside. That is a weird time capsule. They might have your Dragon Ball cards.
Possibly, yeah. You know, Gary, I might still have my Dragon Ball cards.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, they made the cut, huh?
they're light.
That is true.
Yeah. No, there's just like a little, I don't know, 5-quart Sterilite bin that has like all of my garbage Pokemon cards, and those might be in there. Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah. Good Pokemon cards are in a binder. So.
Good. Investment. Yeah.
No, I just like looking at them.
Okay. The ones that you like, not the valuable, yes. Not the foil Charizards.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a foil Charizard, but it's a fucking second edition. So it's worse than dirt.
Yeah. You can pay somebody to take it.
Nope. Let's see. Chris writes, Gary and Kay, I've recently got into running Delta Green, and you've mentioned it a number of times on the show. Now that you're both going to be near each other, is there a possibility you'll be able to give the game a go? Is there any published adventure that you've read that you really like? I haven't run it yet, but plan to run Star Chamber, which sounds both very cool and will be very challenging for the playgroup as they take on two roles. Their agents are a jury of another group of agents who messed up an operation whose stories they also play out in flashbacks. Oh, that sounds fucking rad.
It's tricky. Like any of those two role things in a tabletop game.
Oh, you
I
get
love
into
the idea of.
You get into Revenant shit.
Yeah. Or, yeah. Or, no, Wraith.
Wraith. Yeah. There we go. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, that's crazy. Like that would be very difficult. That's advanced role playing.
Yeah.
But it's a super cool idea. Mm-hmm. So just answering for me, I have played the Delta Green setting, and I have played the old Call of Cthulhu game in a Delta Green setting, so fairly close. Mm-hmm. I have not played modern Delta Green.
No.
As a thing. And the in terms of adventures, I've read several of them. I'm partway through God's Teeth. I put that down, but I read Impossible Landscapes last. There's a collection of adventures called Black Sites that's really good. Mm-hmm. So I read a bunch of the adventures that I think would be cool to do.
Any of them in A Night at the Opera are really good.
It is a game that is challenging to run.
Yeah.
Impossible Landscapes was really fun to read.
Imagine running it.
It's difficult to run. Like it is, it reminds me of, a Burning Wheel book where it almost just feels like a text, like it was never meant to be run. Mm-hmm. I know people have played Burning Wheel. I've played Burning Wheel, but the way that book reads is like, oh, this seems like this would be hard to run.
Yeah.
This is about role-playing games. Like it's almost like a textbook. It almost just feels like you imagine a game in your head. Mm-hmm. A thing that runs up when I think about tabletop playing is that a lot of really cool ideas, you really have to have a group that works for, mm-hmm. and they have to take it the right level of seriously, for that kind of thing. Like for Delta Green in general, I think that you have to take it fairly seriously.
Yeah.
And that has never been my group's strong point. No disparagement to that, but mm-hmm. my group are goofballs. So trying to do something that is meant to be scary, is a hard sell for my
group. Yeah. Especially if you really care, like, you know, if you're really into it, having that kind of mismatch as somebody who puts together a campaign, I could see building some resentment.
it feels bad. It's also a thing where what I found with these kind of things is that when I do try to run that kind of thing, all I'm actually doing is doing the game I would like to play.
Yeah.
But nobody around me is interested in running that. So like, I love the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game and I love Delta Green and stuff. And I've run it a bunch of times. I ran through Horror on the Orient Express, which is a really big mega campaign and stuff. It's very fun to run through, but I would have liked to have played it more than any of my players liked playing it.
Yeah.
Like they liked it, but it was like, I was doing the thing I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Doing for other people the thing I wanted to have done for me, I guess.
It kind of gets into trying to play baseball with yourself kind of territory. Like you can't be the pitcher and the batter and the outfielder, right?
It's a real classic DM problem. Like people, you know, if you end up in a game master role, that is, you know, can be difficult if you want to play mm-hmm. more often. In terms of playing in person, like I'm taking a little tabletop break for mental and physical health at the moment, but maybe at some point. Like, that'd be fun. And definitely, you know, if we start doing streams, we have Duck Stream and stuff like that, we'll have that as part of them. I don't know about space in my life for another regular game. But I don't see why we couldn't figure something out. Like maybe do at our regular tabletop thing, which people call out of all the time, like a West Marches style mm-hmm. Thing where the people who are there are the people who play. You know, things like that. Like there might be a way to do it.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fun. And it's very convenient because you live really close to Levi.
Yeah.
Where it's where you usually play.
Yeah. I need to get more of my basic routine and like life stuff in in place before I start doing other fun stuff like that.
I couldn't commit to anything right now. Like I'm a fucking mess. Like I am getting my head straight. I'm taking a break from a lot of stuff right now. Not doing that now, even myself. And I did not just move across country. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I get that. Yep. Lucky McChancy says, hi folks, some hooligans went and resurrected Dracula again. Castlevania Belmont's Curse will be coming out this year and is being made by the same company behind Dead Cells. On a related note, I'm looking forward to your coverage of Castlevania Bloodlines in March. I always play as Eric Lacard. The iframes on his super jump are real useful in some spots, and spinning a spear comes in handy once or twice. Anyway, who are your favorite Castlevania or classic horror Halloween monsters? Bloodlines is sick. Also, I'm glad I brought that to the show.
Yeah.
I was expecting that to be a compromised Castlevania, and it's not. It's just a hidden... It's like Castlevania 4 if Castlevania 4 did not become Super Castlevania 4.
Yeah.
It's a direct response to Castlevania 3. Not necessarily with the branching paths, but it is a really, really carefully well-made classic Castlevania. Mm-hmm. It's real good.
Yeah. I've never played it, and I haven't picked it up for the show yet.
It's good. I'm playing through as the whip guy because I wanted the familiarity, but I'm going to play through it twice because it's short.
Yeah.
And play through with the spear guy because I like having the different moves up.
Mm-hmm. As far as classic horror, classic favorite Castlevania, I think classic horror monsters, that's a little bit less interesting to me. Like, it's really hard to fuck up with Legion. Anytime Legion shows up, I'm way into it. Grand Falloon, I guess, is sometimes what it's called.
I'm going to go with Skeleton Frisky from Order of Ecclesia.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. I'm way into the Skeleton Waiters, too.
Skeleton Waiters. I like Nova Skeleton as well, mm-hmm. as just kind of a trap. Like, and they do skeletons. Like, this is just on our skeleton bullshit, but
yeah.
I do feel like that series does skeletons better than any other series.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of variety and surprise. Mm-hmm. They are the best skeletons in gaming.
Yeah, they're good at coming up with fun things for a skeleton to be.
In Bloodlines is a minor spoiler, but there's a level where you are in front of a fence, and there are skeletons behind the fence you can't hurt. They're just hucking bones at you.
Yeah.
Over the fence, harassing you as you go through the level.
Uh-huh.
And like, I like to think they're not even working for Dracula. Like,
no.
It's like those people who live in the area of the Running Man. Like when they go down to the Running Man, there's all these people throwing trash at Arnold Schwarzenegger. I like to think that's what these skeletons are. They're just having a day.
Yeah. Let's move on to life questions.
Let's do.
Yeah. Wolfman Fam says, hey, Gary and Kay, what makes good chemistry between game friends? I have a buddy with whom I've made standing appointments for years, and we've made our way through a bunch of games. Some friends, though, the chemistry hasn't worked in the gaming realm, despite it working in the friendship realm. What do you think makes people, quote, work well as co-gamers? That could be for folks who just know each other from gaming, IRL friends who connected over games once in a while, or folks folks like you two who game separately and come together to talk about it. Then they say some very nice things.
There's different answers based on what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, so for Kay and I to talk about games, that is, I like to think, more of a function of our regular friendship than a function of our gaming taste, because our gaming chemistry is not separate. Yeah. But for playing a game, I think that you want to have similar gaming values. That's a dumb phrase, but I'm going to use an example. Let's say you're playing the Larian Masterpiece Divinity Original Sin 2. Mm-hmm. Somebody wants to read the dialogue, someone doesn't.
Yeah.
That's not going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody wants to plan, somebody doesn't, just wants to dive in. That's going to be awkward.
Yeah.
Like, you want to want the same things out of the game. I want to say to play the game well together.
Yeah.
Cooperatively.
That feels like a rhythm thing too.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, and that even comes down to like regularity. Like, I don't know. It's easy to make plans to play games and stuff, and then that just kind of falls through. Like, somebody who is as invested in keeping it going as you are seems important too.
Same level, regardless of how high that level is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also, you want to, you know, think about just that reading or wanting the same thing. Think about Night Rain. You know, the thing, one of the things that put us both off of Night Rain was wanting to stop and consider options.
Yeah.
And that being something that hurt other people. If we found somebody who also wanted to, and part of that's a flaw in the game where if we found somebody else who wanted that, we'd both just lose.
Yeah. Because
that's not how you play the game. But because the meta has evolved to such that, no, there's just a right way to do this and you do it quickly. It just feels not surpassable as a learning curve.
No.
You know, finding people who are on the same page and who want to grow to the other page at the same rate seems daunting and not worth it.
Right.
Yeah. Eric says, if you could have any Inspector Gadget gadget, what would you pick? And what would be your activation phrase? Doesn't have to be anything from the show or from the Matthew Broderick film. Could just be anything plausible. Those films are not plausible. Inspector Gadget is not plausible, my friend.
No, yeah. Not at all.
It's he never asked for this. He is a Denton.
Yeah.
At this point, he is more machine than man and no longer has any essence. Healing magic no longer works on him.
Yeah.
He will not make it into heaven. Like it's.
Yeah, no, killing him doesn't even count as murder.
No, it's less than RoboCop.
Yeah, like of the ones I can remember from the cartoon, like the leg extenders seems cool, not for being tall, but just for like getting around quickly.
Okay, you know? Like I have long legs like the Tim and Eric.
Yeah, yeah. Like you don't even have to like go that far, like where you're above the clouds and you're stomping on people into bloody messes. I think that like even just a little bit to give yourself a little a movement boost would be convenient. You know, like you wouldn't need a stepladder.
You don't want to have the helicopter for getting around quicker?
I don't know how to make my head into a deadly weapon. Fuck, man.
No, I mean, it's only deadly to birds. you just stay in the air.
I trip and I deploy it and I trip and yeah. Suddenly like I am mulching teenagers.
You don't think that if you trip and you deploy your legs you're not gonna smash some teenager into like a wall?
That's not going
it's,
to be
it's
any
all
more
very dangerous.
It's not going to be any more dangerous. Like you're adding blades into the equation with the helicopter.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
I was just thinking in terms of wanting to get around quickly.
Yeah.
It seems very useful. There aren't very many gadgets I need.
Yeah.
In a daily kind of use. I might take the helicopter, even though I always think about if you like flying is not a big motivator for me. Mm-hmm. And I think about if you're flying like bugs.
Yeah.
You know, getting your face. I'm not really into that. So I don't know what I would do. It's tricky. I know it doesn't have to be from the cartoon, but I can't think of even just like a gadget I use that often.
Yeah.
That I don't want. I'm not forgetful. There are people who forget their keys, who forget things. I tend to remember stuff I have with me or that I need.
Yeah.
I have my phone, which does everything. My phone is part of it. And I have my wallet, which is a phone case that has everything I need. I don't know. It's a tricky question.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of things I need.
The actual thing that I want is like an AR, like detective vision kind of deal. Like you technically could get something that approximates that, but it is that entails just limitless AI surveillance of everybody yeah. you're around. Like tremendous ethical concerns on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
What does David have to say about media?
Let's see here. David says, I'm wondering about the sort of high art that you both admire. What is each of your most beloved non-genre novel? Is there a particular painter or piece of art that stirs you the most? Classical composer? Having a hierarchy within art is and always has been an illusion. Warhol was nothing less of a prophet. Was nothing less than a prophet of that notion one day being destroyed. With musicians like 100 Gex and painters like Charlotte Rose and the like, what once was crass and lowbrow is now indistinguishable from good art. Now games have works like Disco Elysium and the Xeno series that can stand shoulder to shoulder with the best of them. Nevertheless, with the world devolving into an emotionally unhinged morass of misplaced values, I think it's healthy to remind myself from time to time of the power of past works of art, even if there was an element of gatekeeping at the time.
Yeah. I like high art in a general sense. The genre in which I am most versed is visual high art. There are many painters who I like quite a bit. I'm a really big Mark Rothko fan. I am a really, really big fan of a man named Dan Flavin, who is currently alive, I want to say, like late mid-century artist who works in light. When I go to a city, I want to go to the art museum. Love modern art. I can spend all day looking at that. That is probably, I also love Andy Warhol. I love all the pop artists.
Yeah.
I love Klaus Otto Oldenburg. Yeah, all that stuff. Big into that.
Yeah.
So that is probably the thing I'm most versed in. Classical, there are classical pieces I like and such. Classical, instead of a composer, I tend to think of just eras though.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Within that, it's a little bit not interchangeable because I know it's not actually interchangeable, but like feels like it. Like I'll put on classical.
Yeah.
I'll put on a composer, you know, as a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The closest that I get to that with a composer is I really like Erik Satie music. Erik Satie compositions. He's the guy who did like Gymnopédias. That is, I think, possibly like the one that I like have put on the most. I find that relaxing. Yes. So that
I like Rachmaninoff, who is not relaxing, but I like that as well.
Yeah. I stayed at a hotel in Cincinnati when I went there. It was called the Symphony. And like it was kind of like a boutique, like Airbnb kind of place. Not Airbnb, just a boutique B&B kind of thing. And each room was themed after a particular composer. I reserved the Brahms suite. Because that is fun. That's a fun idea for a hotel, for a place you're going to sleep. but they upgraded me to the Rachmaninoff room. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also like every nerd, I like Holst. Mm-hmm. The Planets is the classical music for nerds.
Yeah.
But it's because it's good.
Yeah.
You know, I like that as well. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where I feel like anybody who's really into this is still very pedestrian. You know, like
yeah.
I agree with you that hierarchies of art is stupid. That's a fake idea that you have when you're young. Mm-hmm. And has never been less popular.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we're moving into it can all be good.
Yeah.
You know, like old stuff is good. There's a discourse about old stuff every once in a while. It's intolerable.
Yeah.
New stuff is also good.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to be poptimist or classic gatekeepers. There's room for both of it. There's no real reason to choose.
Yeah. And yet I still get a little bit self-conscious because like when I think about visual artists, like I fucking love Beksinski. He is my favorite painter, but that is like a very, I got into it at the era before it was a stereotype. I probably was party to it being a stereotype, you know, of being like, you just like, oh, this guy who paints these horrific scenes, you know, that are actually very beautiful and emotionally moving once you get past the grotesquery of it. You know, it's like, oh, maybe Giger is a little bit too mainstream for me, so I want to go one step to the side and really get into Zdzisław Beksinski. Like the one of his that I really love the most, they're all unnamed, but it's the one with all of these like spires, like little plateaus, and on each of them is like a little group of humanoid figures huddled around bonfires on them. I find that to be very, very moving.
It sucks the movement towards this kind of snobbery or gatekeeping in art does a lot of damage.
Yeah.
Because I understand what you're talking about, but there's no reason why somebody should feel bad about liking a great artist because other people like that great artist.
Because of how you found them, right?
Yeah, because of how you found them or because a lot of other people are into them.
Yeah.
You know, it's also a thing too where like, as you know, it's hard for me to believe in, I do believe in objective quality of things, like to a degree, you know, because I have to be in a world where REM are better than the rednecks objectively.
Yeah.
I can't anticipate, like there is more craft there. There's something there.
That's a cornerstone. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like that is, you know, there cannot be two skies. Yeah. Like that is a thing that has to be true for me to be alive and exist in the world. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, the level of subjectivity in this shit, I never really care whether anybody likes or dislikes a thing. Mm-hmm. If somebody likes a thing that I think is shit, that, you know, I'm like, oh, I have a momentary, like, oh, that thing's shit. Mm-hmm. But it's never affected my feeling of them personally.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't matter. And same thing vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, somebody doesn't like something, it's like, okay, yeah, that's fine. There's plenty of things that are ostensibly good that I don't like as well.
Yeah.
it doesn't simultaneously matters more than anything in the world and doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Your attitude towards art,
like it is an incredibly personal thing. Like it is an internal universe of appreciation as opposed to it being any kind of like social dynamic, or at least for me, like the social side of it is not strongly expressed. Right.
What's crazy too, is that like, there are degrees of subjectivity in these things. Like I like to think that music, I sometimes think that music is like the most subjective genre, right? Like something just sounds good to you or doesn't.
Yeah.
You can learn to appreciate it. You can learn the things, but it speaks to you somewhere deeper than that. But I also think about food, and there's artistry to food, but people who get snobby about food taste, like you don't taste things the same way I do.
Yeah.
Like that's literally a thing where the foods taste different to other people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
So like if somebody's like, oh, I can't believe you don't like, you know, mussels, you know, and it's like, well, they don't taste good to me. It tastes a different way to me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm having a completely different experience. They're not comparable. Mm-hmm. You know, like we can both appreciate the craft of how this thing was developed and cooked and prepared and stuff, but it doesn't matter because it doesn't taste good to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole morass. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about.
The trickiest one of these is the non-genre novel, because every book to me can be put into, you know, like I think the closest thing that I could like, you know, that I like enough that does not fit into like a genre, like wouldn't be like filed in a special section at the bookstore, would be Confederacy of Dunces. But that's a comedy book. Like it's comedy, yeah. Like it is social commentary, but you know, you could say like, oh yeah, that's a comedy book. That doesn't count. I think that is where you start kind of getting at the bad and incredibly, let's say slippery side of that particular razor. How you carve that up can disqualify any number of things that somebody might enjoy a lot.
Yeah. It's tricky. You know, it does a non-genre book have to be about librarians in New York coming to terms with things?
Yeah.
You know, like I think about the author George Saunders, who I like a lot, Pastor Alia, Civil War, Land and Bad Decline. Those are also funny books.
Yes.
And I think about Kurt Vonnegut, my favorite author of all time. I've read everything he's done.
Yeah.
Those are oftentimes sci-fi or at least sci-fi adjacent. I really genuinely like the novel 1984. That's a real also kids first big boy novel kind of thing. But that also has sci-fi elements.
Yep.
To it. Like, I think it's a good book, but like, if you want to gerrymander it out of contention, you can. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, if your answer is not, I don't know, like The Great Gatsby or The Corrections, it feels like there's a way to just, this has to be about rich New Yorkers.
Yeah.
That's what literature is. It's rich New Yorkers only.
Yeah. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, you like Thomas Pynchon. Oh, well, so you like crime thrillers? Well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. Why are we playing definition games? You know, I'm not accusing David of doing this, just part of how the conversation can get frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get too old for that shit. Mm-hmm. Like I cannot imagine engaging seriously with that kind of thing the way I did when I was younger.
Yeah.
Like life is so fucking short.
Yeah. It really is. Doing? Like I need to be able to talk about how much I love The Snow Leopard by Peter Matheson without like getting into a discussion of whether that is just a travelogue or not.
Yeah. Right? Whether it counts, you know, spending time figuring out whether it's pretty similar to the thing we talked about with, defining retro for games.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different thing because it's about qualitatively, but it is, instead of discussing the thing, it's discussing whether the thing counts. Mm-hmm. And that is almost always a less interesting discussion, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and you're not going to get anything from the person. It's not an enriching discussion.
Yeah.
No. So hopefully that is a good answer for that stuff.
Yeah.
Otter says, hello, Kay and Big G. I originally found the network through Bonfireside Chat and later moved on to listening to the rest of the active series. My question is there a noticeable increase in viewership whenever you start a new series, for example, Unfilmable?
Not really.
Nobody views these. They're audio.
Yeah. Really, the only thing that has a direct correlation to how much listenership we get is whether or not Bonfireside Chat is active at the time. Everything else is attracting not necessarily numbers of people, but just different groups of people.
Yeah. Like a bunch of, when you started doing Real Rich Hours, people dug it. And there are people who were like, oh, this is the show I like, you know, but it wasn't a bringing in people.
Yeah.
it is still really weird to me after all these years and having developed what could be considered a body of work that there are so many people who are really disinterested in me when I'm only talking about a specific kind of game from a specific kind of company. Mm-hmm. You know, that can feel, can kind of generate some feel bads.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But I've accepted because it's the nature of the world.
Yeah. Like
the world is that which is the case. Those people exist. That's fine. I'm grateful to have them when we have them. And I'm also looking forward to the next thing from Soft Does that is worth our attention.
Yes. Yeah. Walt Shipman says, from Monster in My Podcast to Real Itch Hours, you two have consistently been one of the premier sources for all things Sourcebook. With that in mind, have you ever thought about, have you ever put any thought towards a full-blown tabletop RPG podcast? The recent relocation of Duckfeed HQ to Portland obviously must be turned into content. The people cry out for a Duckfeed actual play show. No, it doesn't need to be turned into content. It is nice. Yeah. It is nice that, that it might possibly, we can experiment with it. Options are really great. That is not why I did this.
Yeah. I have tried to do a actual play podcast before. Mm-hmm. I find them difficult and a pain to edit.
Yeah.
I also, my taste in them is out of step with current trends. Like, it would be a way to maybe bring people in. You know, we're talking, like, in reference to the last question, these have never been more popular. Mm-hmm. People love this shit. But people love them primarily in a very highly edited, produced fashion that is very time consuming.
Yeah.
You know, that would be very hard to do with the rest of the things we do. Mm-hmm. I want to say,
I like that. That would almost need to be something where we need to like bring in a collaborator who specifically does the cinematic kind of stuff, but also like running those, like running something for a show and running something for your friends to have fun with, very different things.
Yeah. Like we would need to have a producer, you know, and we would play.
Yeah.
In the game and stuff. And that brings in a whole other can of worms. Like a producer other than Gwen.
Yes.
Like, I mean, somebody who specifically did this.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, someday something like that might happen intermittently. I don't think it'll be a new show.
No.
We're also still on the no new shows.
Yeah.
Kick. We got enough shows. We doubled Unfilmable.
Yeah. I like Real Itch Hours as an outlet for that.
Yeah.
I think that fits really well with like both of our competencies and also like both of our enthusiasms.
Yeah. And it straddles the line. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's do one more show and then move to lightning round.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to do this show question though. Richard says, hi, Gary and Kay. Firstly, thanks for bringing Unfilmable to my ears twice as often. Very nice words. Thank you. Appreciate it. And then says, my question is, what can we not expect to ever see on the schedule? Basically, what's on your banned list? I expect Gary will boycott Jigsaw and Spiral and the other later Saw films. I'd be shocked if you covered anything as grim as those famous Centipede films or films of equal artistic merit. So for the record, Saw is not banned from the show.
It's just your involvement. Yeah.
So we talked about having guests from time to time. Mm-hmm. That'd be a great, you want to talk about a Saw?
Oh, Will's the guy. Yeah.
I think Will would talk to you about it. I'm sure Gwen would, and that'd be a fun episode and stuff. Like, I don't want to be kicked off the show, but I would take a break. Mm-hmm. And because mostly I don't want to stop you from talking about a thing you want to talk about.
Yeah.
You know? So those aren't the things that I think would be banned are things that are in like exceedingly poor taste, like a Serbian film.
Yeah. Really, no, that was going to be the thing that I was going to say is just like, I think that even came up in our discussions about, about like, okay, like what counts under the feel bad rainbow.
Yeah. Like something that feels so relentlessly bleak like that. I think we could probably talk about that. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of Unfilmable is not to do things that are good.
Yeah.
It's to have things that are interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
So yeah, that would be interesting to talk about. I just don't want the experience of it.
No.
It's weird because that movie gets lumped in with a game or a movie I do want to do, which is called Funny Games, which is also very nihilistic and miserable as a movie, but I think it is more towards a point.
Nobody sexually assaults a baby in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of gross. You know, we didn't do Fear and Hunger. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's certain subject matter. Just like even though there's something interesting to this, it is not an artless mm-hmm. subject. Like you can do art about this. I just don't really feel like being exposed to it and talking about it.
Yeah.
Both from a navigating it perspective and from just the experience of doing it.
Yeah. I'm not going to come out gunning and saying like Salo shouldn't exist. Just do not want to. It's our show. I don't want to talk about it very much.
Yeah. I also don't think I have that much interesting to say about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. I also think in terms of just stuff that's on like the no-go list, I probably don't want to do things like Human Centipede, not because they're like that, because they're so schlocky, but because I am skeptical that there's a lot of merit to it.
Yeah.
It feels, you know, there's a certain kind of grindhouse shock cinema mm-hmm. that I don't think I have interesting things to say.
Yeah.
You know, it's fine that it exists, but it just feels like it's there for the premise, mm-hmm. you know, more than anything.
And like, I don't know, I'm not going to do Faces of Death on the show.
No. Nothing where real people died. Nothing where actual people got hurt. Nothing that's actually racist.
Yeah.
You know, nothing that's actually harmful.
Yeah.
Like, that's no fun.
Not at all.
No. Let's do some lightning round.
Let's lightning round it up. Videogames.Afghanistan asks, ever play Lufia 2?
Yeah. I don't remember it very well, mm-hmm. But I did play Lufia 2.
I never played it, but I read a walkthrough of it in Nintendo Power and played it in my head.
There you go.
Yeah.
A fun thing to do. Fermented Sorcerer says, if you could bring back any store for one last visit, what would you bring back? That question is a sniper bullet to my heart. That's something I think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of like big stores, I would love to go to Toys R Us from when I was young. But the real answer is Legends and Lore, the comic book and comic book store from when I was young, mm-hmm. That also sold like gaming shit.
Yeah.
Run by my friend at the time, Scott Lore. His last name was Lore. Pretty sick.
That's great.
And going there with money and the knowledge I have now would be fucking incredible.
Yes.
Like I would buy it out, not just from like a Back to the Future 2 investment standpoint, like, oh yeah, I'll buy a couple boxes of revised Magic cards for $200. But also I would just like, shit, I want this thing and it's available.
Yeah.
Here are all of the D&D second edition complete guide to classes and they're all just MSRP.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's not surprising. Our answer is basically the same. Mine was the comic and gaming store from Mansfield, Ohio, where, you know, around where I grew up, called Comic Adventures. But like, mm-hmm. I was super young when I went to that. Like, I went there to play Pokemon cards. Mm-hmm. Like, they had tournaments and stuff there. I think there was a Pokemon League there as well. And buy X-Men comics. Like that, like yeah. I would love to go back to that just to see how it lines up with my memory.
Even if I just like quantum leaped and I was still young,
yeah,
I would love to have my perspective now and be there. I remember Scott Lore, I was a little X-Men kid. I was buying X-Men. I got really excited when Generation X and X-Men 2099 came out.
Oh, Generation X, yeah.
Like new things to jump on, right? I was like, oh, it's an X-Men number one. I can be on the ground floor. Mm-hmm. And Scott trying to get me into Preacher. Rather,
yeah.
Garth Ennis, which like you can talk about whether that's good or not. At the time, it was really important comics. I still think there's something to that comic. I don't want to get into it. But the it was definitely headier and more interesting than Scott Lobdell's Generation X. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, no, that doesn't have X-Men in it. But I wonder what my life would have been like if I had read things that were doing things with the medium earlier. You know, like it's just fascinating shit.
Like there's also stuff that like got a lot of promotion that loomed larger in my head because I just saw a lot of it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if you just went by my experiences at Comic Adventures, you would think that Kingdom Come was a bigger deal than it ended up being. Right.
And Kingdom Come was a really big deal. It just didn't spawn anything.
Yeah.
Like it coming out was a big deal. And then it was a done in one. Like there's a weird sequel to that, but it's also, like thinking back to that time, things that would not actually be a thing is I wish I wasn't a snob at the time. Mm-hmm. Like I remember people being really into Bone, the Jeff Smith comic, and that's really good. It's just about little cartoon animals. Like it's a really good like fantasy story.
Yeah.
Love Bone. But it looks too kiddie. And mm-hmm. I was like, no, this doesn't have gambits in it. Like this, I need people with goatees or I'm out. You know, like you must be this grifter. You must be this Wildstorm to ride. And that was stupid. I cut myself off from a lot of bullshit, like a lot of good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Fermented Sorcerer also asked, hi, favorite guns and FPSs?
Good question.
Yeah.
Portal gun, super shotgun in Doom 2, glue gun in Prey.
Yeah. Those are all good ones. I was going to throw in the glue gun. But I will say the shotgun in, if I'm pulling from Half-Life, I'm going to say the sniper crossbow in that.
That's really good.
Yeah. And then I know it's a terrible gun in the games, but I love it aesthetically and I love the idea of what it does. The Needler in Halo.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good guns. Drew asked, Gary, are you looking forward to Mugenics? Mugenics is out. I've not started playing it yet. I am trying to get a handle on I'm doing some work-life balance, Gary stuff right now before I dive into a thing I'm definitely going to spend $500 or 500 hours on. And I would love for it to come out on Switch.
Yeah.
I know I can play on Steam Deck, but like if it is going to fill an Isaac Monster Train hole in my life, I need to be able to play it like in the living room while Liv's watching TV or something.
Yeah.
So I haven't tried it on Steam Deck yet. It's just I'm standing on a precipice of something that I know is going to take a lot of me. Like it was a weird thing to say, but I get it. XCOM Isaac.
Yeah.
Like there's no world. It's XCOM Into the Breach Isaac. Like there's no world in which this is not just made for me.
Yeah.
So like I'm just a little bit scared of it. So yes, I'm looking forward to it, but in the way that like you look forward to meeting God when you die. Like it is awful. It is great and terrible.
Jesus.
You know, it is great and terrible, great in the not necessarily
like value judgment sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. let's see here. Bo writes, lightning round question. If there was a story of Duck Feed movie in pre-production, and you both were given carte blanche to fill creative roles, who'd star, who'd direct, who'd shoot and who'd write?
Imagine that movie. Like it'd mostly be us in our own places.
Yeah.
Talking once a week. Like it would be like the origins of one message board post a week from time to time.
the premise is facially it's ridiculous. Yeah.
Casting yourself in a movie is always feels hard to be not to be arrogant.
Yeah.
My stock answer for a long time when he was alive was Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Same.
I think he's a good actor and he's got a body type that isn't entirely unlike mine. Mm-hmm. You know, can play, and has a wide range.
Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman, like it would need to be like digitally double twins of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like we need to get some clumps situation going on. Yeah.
Get some holograms.
Yeah.
Get some AI Hoffmans. and then for directing and shooting, you'd want somebody who could really do kinetic visual acting of the Something Awful message boards.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like something really twitchy, like a David Fincher kind of thing. So like when you did a close up on the post, they were like shaky.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the font was real scary, like blood font.
It just really brings some edge to it, I think.
Yeah.
Who'd shoot? I don't necessarily. Yeah. I don't see the distinction between that and director. Like,
yeah. I understand what it is in real movies, but
yeah,
for purposes of this.
Yeah. For purposes of this. Yeah. I cannot name off the top of my head a cinematographer. Different kind of film nerd.
Yeah. And then writer would have to be Charlie Kaufman because they would make this dumb thing interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I think they could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Charlie Kaufman would absolutely be able to, look at adaptation, right?
Yeah.
Like,
it wouldn't be accurate.
No, not at all.
It wouldn't matter, though. It would just be a more fun movie.
Yeah.
I think we pitched like a movie that I think sounds cool. Charlie Kaufman doing a double Philip Seymour Hoffman movie.
About
anything, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Jordan and Maya say, two-part question for the good podcasters. One, who is your favorite animal sidekick in media? Two, which animal sidekick would you force your co-host to adopt to inflict maximum annoyance on? Let's throw Will in here too so you can give him some sort of nightmare beast.
My answer for all three is Lion Cat from Saga.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Will having Lion Cat would be really difficult. Will doesn't tell the truth a lot. That's a good one. Favorite animal sidekick in media. I'm pretty affectionate with Sif. I think Sif is real fun.
Yeah.
Sif is cute and good. And then in terms of giving a problem, I will say for you, I'm going to say the ever-growing Super 8 from the Rampage film. So just a logistical problem. Now you've moved into a smaller place. And for Will, I'm going to say Lion Cat because he doesn't like telling the truth.
Right. It is counter to his nature. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally here we have two questions from Molten Burl. First, if it turns out that the network has a curse that prevents it from continuing if Gary and Kay are in the same city for more than a month or two at a time, who gets custody of Game Computer?
What a specific curse.
Also, Will. I like the idea that like Will would be cursed with this thing that just beeps anytime something approaching the title of a game is mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, he might like that, though. He likes naming the titles of things.
He does, yeah.
Yeah. Secondly, in the Better Call Saul episode Gloves Off, Mike and Lawson sort of feel each other out on a level of expertise and knowledge by discussing the technical aspects of the guns in question. What would your equivalent topics be, and how would you go about evaluating somebody without getting gatekeepy? I mean, this is going to sound like virtue signaling. I can't imagine doing that.
Yeah.
I don't evaluate. I just say the thing. I don't do anything like that anymore. I can't. And it's not because I'm good. It's because I can't handle it. Like the idea of like going to a mechanic or something and being like, yeah. So let me run a fake question by you just to see if you know your stuff. Yeah.
Any question that begins with a big sniff, like,
yeah.
Or like, kind of what you think in the kind of wrench you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't do that anymore. I can't.
No.
Life. I don't have the energy for that anymore.
No.
Which means I'm a fucking rube and you can take advantage of me.
Yeah.
You know, this is the sad part, but luckily you don't know where I live.
That's the thing. Yeah. No. I don't know. Like, if I was feeling somebody out and they knew something and they knew less than me, my instinct would be to help them if it seemed like they were receptive to help. Now that's virtue signaling.
Yeah. I would just, or you'd also just like ask.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you know, this is something I know a bunch about. Are you super familiar with this?
Yeah. It's like, oh, you said something really wrong that might come and bite you. Do you actually want information about this?
Like actually, this is this.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
I learned a long time ago before I started info dumping, actually ask permission.
Yeah. 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 It's a good instinct.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the topic.
Let's. Let me go down here. Bryn, Bonfireside Chat alum Bryn, says, I did not grow up playing CRPGs or tactical, what are TCGs?
Nope. Trading card games.
Trading card games. There we go. But in the last 5 years of my 30s, I have suddenly become enamored with both. Weirdly, I hold falling in love with Dark Souls responsible. Learning how to manage the at first overwhelming stats and abilities menu, and then feel those changes expressed through play, through the very moveset of your character. It opened up my eyes to what was interesting about engaging with that type of system, which led me to trying other games that were, quote, like Dark Souls. I'm playing through Planescape Torment right now on a Windows 98 computer, and it's kind of because of Dark Souls. That sounds amazing. I love that. Yeah. Going back to the original
Windows
system.
98 computer.
Yeah. She continues, not 5 years ago, I would have said a lot of this stuff, quote, isn't, quote, for me. I grew up a Genesis and PC kid, loving twitchy platformers and point-and-click adventure games. But through a lot of dedication, learning, and passionate friends' help, I've come to really enjoy some games that would have felt impenetrable to me before. So my question is, how do you differentiate between something that is, quote, not being for you, and something being a genre of game that just hasn't resonated with you yet? Do you ever feel like you've written off experiences or genres because you associate it with something that you bounced off of previously? And as critics, how do you decide when a system is failing to deliver delicious treats and when the system has perfectly baked and delivered the treats? You just don't like the taste. Hope y'all are doing well. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So good question.
Yeah.
I preface this by saying I'm not perfect. I accidentally do this in air. I probably write things off because of past experiences in ways that are not fair. Mm-hmm. And as much as I would like to say I'm just open mind, I'm like, yeah, I'll just try anything. That's not true.
Yeah.
My time is limited and my energy is limited. And there are things where I am making like educated guesses.
Yeah.
You know, like hyper-competitive fighting game. Mm-hmm. It might exist out there that I would really like it. One that I would really like. I feel the odds are low enough that I would rather spend my time elsewise now, mm-hmm. with also allowing the possibility that I could have just a moment where I get way into it.
Right.
Like that could happen. I'm not pursuing it. I'm not worried about the opportunity cost of it happening or trying to set up avenues for it to happen.
Right. Like there's a world in which you really get into that new, what, Arc Systems, X-Men fighting game or superhero fighting game. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, you're not a Guilty Gear person.
No, there's a world in which I get into Marvel rivals.
Yeah.
I'm also not a hero shooter, person.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of, I can like the subject matter. And that's what's kind of interesting about, you know, when I first read the last sentence of the paragraph, I'm playing through Planescape Torment because of Dark Souls. I first read that as because it's kind of like Dark Souls. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how games almost kind of uniquely have a match of a play genre and subject matter genre.
Yeah.
And you can branch out to adjacent things from either direction.
Right.
You know, and that's something that games are unique in, and that I can imagine somebody being like, oh, this has some kind of similar themes of a dark, oppressive world. You are an amnesiac protagonist who doesn't know anything, who's learning about the world and stuff. Like there are similarities with Dark Souls, and I can imagine somebody who loves Dark Souls for the story and exploration being like, yeah, Planescape is similar to that. You know, so that's a thing too, where you have to think about that in terms of what you don't like. Like, is there a coat of paint on a hero shooter that'll make me like it enough? Alternatively, is there a coat of paint on like an SRPG that'll make me not like it enough?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know,
there
and the answer to both is yes. Or like, you know, is yeah. Like I'm not real into this Gaia games. They look like shit, you know, like, I know it's my genre, but like, I don't want to go 100 levels into a sword.
No.
To like see a tit. Like I can see a tit in real life. I don't need to look at a panty from a printy in a video game. And that's not my, I'm not that kind of beast.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
God, I just, a very powerful phrase that you've probably heard me say, I think even in this episode, different kind of nerd.
Yeah.
Right?
Different kind of nerd.
Just like the, like when something comes up and like you come up short. Nope. Just different kind of nerd.
Yeah. Not, I don't have that. I can't have that nostalgia.
Yeah.
So
like an example of this for me, to kind of like add on to that distinction, because like you saying like, oh, is there a coat of paint that could turn me off of something that I really enjoy, kind of unlock that for me. I don't like racing games very much. Like I don't find an awful lot to enjoy. I never play for score. Competitive play, not necessarily for me. You know, like had fun with like Daytona USA in the arcade back in the day. And obviously the Burnout series has a lot to recommend it, but that is auxiliary to actually finishing first in a race. Mm-hmm. That made me think, I don't like car games. It made me think, I don't like cars. Then I discovered like my summer car and like the SnowRunner, MudRunner, RoadCraft series. And it's like, oh, I actually really am interested in the mechanics of these things and navigating space in them. It's just not about going fast. It is about really thinking about the physicality of the object that unlocks this for me.
Yeah. They're different approaches to the same thing.
Yeah. So like something can be like an exquisite racing game, either like in an arcade sense, or in like a sim sense. I'm not going to sit down and play like iRacing. Because I don't have, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to spend on gear and DLC and shit like that. It's just all of that simminess is to an end that I do not prefer. Like it is baking up that treat very, very well. I just don't like the taste of it. But like there is just like a difference in emphasis that actually does bring it around to me and, you know, make it into something that is for me by being a different genre that within the same subject matter.
Yeah, it makes it stretches over in subject matter, but not in genre.
Yeah.
You know, and it does it in a genre that you like.
Yeah.
Like, I can think of things like that I would dig if it's something that I don't, like, specifically object to. Mm-hmm. A good example of that is that, and this is also a thing that for me, in terms of how I navigate it, is a pendulum kind of thing. Like, this kind of navigates itself and I ride on it, it feels like. Yeah. I am moving towards an arcade feel. Mm-hmm. Recently, I have parted probably because of mental health and world state, but like simple goals and simple actions have felt good to me.
Yeah.
I like shoot 'em ups. You know, I talked about this before. Shoot 'em ups are too hard. Like serious shoot 'em ups are real sicko things. But there's a game, they just released a new version of the Cotton series, which is aesthetic poison to me.
It is like Cotton and Candy? Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, yeah. Little anime witch doing stuff that I picked up on Switch because it was on sale and it's really fun.
Yeah.
I do like shoot 'em ups. Like I came for the genre.
Yeah.
Of that. It's not making me appreciate different things about tiny witches. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the car example, that's an object that has multiple ways you can kind of approach it.
Yeah.
And I suppose you can do that with tiny witches. Like there could be a tiny witch simulator, stuff like that. It's not transferring me over to enjoying the subject.
Finding your lost cat in the Alps.
Yeah. I don't need to find my lost cat in the Alps as a tiny, tiny witch. I don't need to open a tea house, anything like that, but that'll happen sometimes. But like in terms of thinking of the pendulum, so moving back into a Twitch mindset, but very specifically wanting simplicity, like it's something I used to be into, mm-hmm. You know, it's not a regression because it goes back and forth, but like, you know, I'm not super into like a Neo, like yeah. Looking at Neo 3 makes me exhausted. I have no interest in playing that game. That, mm-hmm. That looks like hell to me, but I've been like into playing like action platformers from old times.
Yeah.
You were talking about this. Like I was playing Rystar and it's like, this is pretty fun.
Yeah.
It's not complicated. It's hard for me to critically evaluate, you know, it does what it needs to do though. Mm-hmm. And I am enjoying being presented with those goals right now. I have come around on it.
Yeah.
As a thing that kind of happened against my will. I just happened while I was sleeping one day.
Yeah. God, how about the soundtrack on Rystar?
It's good.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to listen on mute a lot of the time because I play next to Liv when she's sleeping, mm-hmm. or she's watching TV. But when I've listened to it, it has been good.
Yeah. That is neither here nor there. This is the soundtrack thing. I just have a lot of nostalgia for that game in particular. Going in and out of modes, I think is the time when the boundaries on these things get thin. Right.
Yes.
And you know, something that previously would not have been for you. I think the Rystar people in this is called Rystar, whatever. I think that that is an interesting
Are
one
you
because
people? Is that your way of sneaking in? Okay.
No. I have said Rystar my entire life. And then people have come in and said, that is a weird way to pronounce that. And I am not going to change. I'm not going to change for you.
Thinking that matters.
Yeah. But you don't have any specific like nostalgia for that game. It is nostalgia for the mode, right?
Yes. It's a lot of nostalgia for the mode and like a place in my life when those are my concerns and other games like it. Mm-hmm. Like me feeling in the weird place between wanting to replay Super Mario World and wanting a Super Mario World experience.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
I want to play something. I want to play a platformer of that era mm-hmm. as a thing. And I'm moving out of a no Twitch allowed mode. I don't typically like Twitch gaming. I don't like use like action gaming that much. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of happening. So like in terms of writing things off, I would not say that I wrote off a Rystar. Mm-hmm. Rotisserie. Kenny Roaster's Rystars.
Restare.
Restare. I wouldn't say I wrote it off, but I wasn't motivated. I was like, not really my thing. Not that kind of nerd. And that just kind of happened. In terms of like evaluating like whether this is something that is making a good treat or not, that's difficult. I like to think I'm good at that. And I feel like most critics probably like to think that they're good at it, but mm-hmm. I don't think anyone's really perfect at it. You know, my perennial example of that is I think that, what is the game about being a car and playing soccer? It's a perennial example I use a lot.
Being a car.
You're a car. It's an action game. You're a car. It's an arena. You're the car. You're
Rocket League. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were talking about like the Koro Q series. I was like, okay.
I don't even know what that is. My perennial example is always Rocket League, though.
The Koro Q series, we did one on Abject Suffering. It's where the car, like there was a president car. Like it's a racing game, but like the cars exist in a world and you do like RPG stuff, like talking to cars as characters.
Yeah. I have vague memories of that.
Yeah.
We've done hundreds of those.
We have.
I only remember the most recent one, but like Rocket League is always my perennial example of like, this is 100% a good treat. Like I can see what this is doing. This is a pretty smart idea.
Yeah.
This has the semiotics of fun to it. It's just, this is not a treat I want the taste of, mm-hmm. you know, and it just comes from like seeing whether the things it does feel like they are fair, looking at what it's trying to do and seeing if it does the thing it's trying to do, regardless of whether I like it, mm-hmm. you know, and that can be difficult. You have to separate yourself from yourself a little bit.
Biases run deep. Right.
Yeah.
You know, like there's, I mean, people could probably point to a million examples on the shows, you know, where I've written something off because of something that we've talked about here. You know, I think that, for as much as I get frustrated when I'm looking on Steam and a game looks really cool, you know, like looking for something to stream or whatever, I get frustrated and oh, turns out it's a co-op four player, you know, horror game. And it's like, oh, I would totally be into this, or I can read about the way that it works, but like, I am not disposed to enjoy what the kids call friend slop.
Yeah.
You know,
it just, yeah, just, but, just not my thing. And that might change.
Yeah.
And I think that you on some level probably have the ability to evaluate friend slop.
I do. Like, yeah.
You
like
could, you could play that game and decide whether, you know, make a relatively informed decision, whether it was succeeding at what it was trying to do.
You know, even just hearing about it, like on the level, I can hear Dennis or somebody describe, you know, like their time with the game and like appreciate their experience with it secondhand based on the way that they relate it and say like, oh, this one sounds better than the other one. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds neat. Yes. You know, this comes up. I've said this before and it always sounds like a sideways insult, but it's 100% not. My favorite thing about Will's writing on the AV Club is that he can write about liking something that I know I hate. Mm-hmm. And he will sell me on why he likes it really well.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make me like it. Mm-hmm. You know, he can talk about a Neo 3 or just something that like to me sounds like hell. You know, like I could not play that with somebody else's hands. That is so not interesting to me. But I like the way he writes about it in a way that makes me understand the quality that is getting across.
Yeah.
Makes me understand it's a good treat. It's just not my treat.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. So like getting to the core of the question here, like how can you tell when something is just not for you or when it's not for you yet? I don't think you can really, you know, make that decision. I think that you know, you just have to, I don't know, maybe sometimes consciously try and get yourself out of a rut with something, you know, give something a chance. I think that is a way that doing these shows functions very well for us. Right.
I think that you definitely owe it to yourself to give things chances in broad categories, you know, at least once, right?
Every once in a while. Like, yeah.
At least once in a while. Like, yeah, you revisit the idea of a thing from time to time to re-up your dislike.
Yeah.
You know, get your rollover dislikes and just check on yourself. I think though, in terms of, I'll go a little bit further on the first question and say that I don't think it is important to determine if something is not for you temporarily or forever.
Yeah.
You'll check back in at a time where you're feeling different. Mm-hmm. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, there is a mindset that sometimes people have like this. I remember getting in discussions on the Slack about this. There are people, and this is not a judgment. This is just not how I choose to engage with media. This makes these people happy. That's good. I don't want to take anything away from people. I wouldn't if I could. But where they, if they don't like something, it is kind of a challenge. Like this is a vegetable. Mm-hmm. I have to figure out how to like this. And the fact that I don't like it now means that I will like it more when I eventually like it.
Yeah.
And I have never experienced that. The times I have forced myself to like, for example, finish a book I hated, I have found it to be virtuous in my life to learn to give up on things.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I'll never go back to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I will probably. I'll come back and check on them, but I don't want to force it now because I don't think I will get what I would get as much from it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I will have as good a time or end up, like in my experience, it makes me like things less.
Yeah.
When I do that.
No, like all it will do is if I'm just resenting it the whole time, finishing it, like I'm still going to resent that time.
Yeah. and there are folk who do not resent their time and that's cool.
Yeah.
Good. You know, like I wish I had that, mm-hmm. you know, and people can accuse us, you know, and be wise, accuse is too strong a word, but people will say like, oh, that's because of the job. That's because you play on a deadline and stuff. And I like to think that I keep that stuff separated, but maybe I'd be surprised if it doesn't contribute at least a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it is also the world is that which is the case.
Yeah.
You know, me pretending it's not doesn't do anything.
Yeah. And our stock answer for that is like, well, maybe the job is, you know, influencing my read on it. Maybe this, you know, is kind of putting some spin on my rejection of this thing. But like, how many times do we talk about hitting the I get it button or just saying like, no, I would have stopped playing this. I only kept playing it because we made a promise to for the show, right?
Those are times when it's the opposite. Like it's not, you know, that part, that line showed up earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it won the race as a thing. And it's also a thing too, where like, I am not that interested in the process of separating myself from my brain.
No.
As a thing, like when I think about that, like the practical truth of the things is a lot of times playing on a deadline won't affect things. Like I'm pretty far ahead on work right now.
Yeah.
I still have the same dumb fucking brain that like makes me anxious about time.
Yeah.
Like that didn't get fixed. Mm-hmm. So even me being ahead and not having to play these things on an actual deadline, I still feel the feelings.
Yeah.
You know, I can try to cognitive behavioral therapy my way out of it, but that is oftentimes a losing battle.
Yeah. And also that willpower. Okay. I was about to say something. It's been disproven that you have a limited amount of willpower that you can exert. And then that's a bad thing. However, if I am prioritizing and triaging the things that I'm going to CBT myself through, making myself like a piece of media or a game, is going to be lower on that list.
Yes.
That's not going to be top priority.
I don't have limited willpower, but I do have a choice of how I spend my time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's not even necessarily about, and I think you can have limited energy, if not willpower. Like it feels objectively true that for me, it does take more energy to start a new TV show than to watch an old episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah. There's a setup cost.
There's a setup cost. It takes more energy for me to watch a new show than to watch a new episode of The Simpsons I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. Like there is a setup cost. There's energy involved in that. And whether that has scientifically been disproven, whether that's real, the feeling that it's real is too strong to ignore.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very attractive model because it bears out in any number of recognizable circumstances.
It feels right. It's intuitive. It makes intuitive sense, and it feels right to lived experience.
Yeah,
you know what else do I have except for lived experience?
Yeah,
you know. So not to get too drifty from the actual question, but hopefully we got there somewhere in there.
I'm just happy that we got to. It's okay for you to like what you like.
Yeah, we have to make sure we say that twice a month or we lose funding from George Soros. So.
Oh my God. Let's do game responses.
Responses. Yeah, you read the question, so I'll get us started here with questions or answers about Mega Man X4. This is with Fred, and Fred says, I think X4 sits at an interesting place in the PlayStation trilogy. It's clearly got the most polish and charm, and while X5 and X6 do refine some things, you can tell they're just too rushed all over and feel like weaker products, to the point where you wonder why it's even an option to play as unarmored X in X6, because some stages have jumps he physically cannot make. Overall, while I feel like there is a hypothetical ideal PS-era X game, none of these are it, but X4 is definitely the closest. It's just such a shame that at this point in the series' lifetime, the machine was breaking down the same way it was trying to pick itself up steam. At the same time, it was trying to pick up steam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like this is on, you know, on point. X4 is the best of them. There is slop in X5 and X6. X6 especially. I think that there are things to really enjoy in X5. But like the new hardware was not enough to breathe actual new life into this kind of game, into this series, and this team working on this kind of game.
Mega Man and Mega Man X are interesting series because I think, not completely uniquely, but it's one of the series where it's hard to talk about them without talking about a series context.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, since I only have played to completion X1 and X4, there's a lot of things I don't know about that. Like if we were talking about the original Mega Man series, I can kind of chart those comparatively, and I can't really chart them with X. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how true this is.
Yeah.
I'll defer to you.
Yeah. So Joey writes, the first four X games and the first six or so games of the main series hold a very special place in my heart. I was born in 87, so I was the perfect age for the X games to hit right. Radical. X is the perfect game that I replay every year or two. And I think that X4 is the only other one that approaches that X1 and Mega Man 2 through 4, 2 is still the best, tier. The soundtrack is kind of a return to form as well, which along with playing as Zero helps make this one stand out. The descriptions for each level are absolutely everything. He left with a space fortress to conquer the air. He destroyed the city and escaped to the sea. And he defends the military train to protect the supply of goods.
I love goods.
Are just so vague and hilarious. Thanks for finally covering the game. It's flawed and makes some deeply bizarre choices, but it's always super fun to revisit.
Yeah. You're welcome. It was fun.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to Kate for putting on there. I love supply of goods. Like, one of my favorite things to have in my house is a supply of goods, and I love to protect my supply of goods.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, just he destroyed the city and fled to the sea. Like, yeah. I love that as like a triptych.
Opening line of a novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just, Ben says, when Mega Man X4 was relatively fresh, with it relatively fresh in your brains, I like to bring you into a game my daughter and I were playing on a recent road trip. Make up your own Maverick bosses by combining an exotic animal and a power/element/vague concept. Bonus points for their special weapon and weaknesses. Highlight from the mind of my 9-year-old include Aqua Axolotl, Megaton Giraffe, and Lightning Rattlesnake. By the way, have either of you messed around with Mega Man X mods? How you'll blast with the X1-3 Matrix Cross randomizer now?
I didn't know this existed. I could have guessed, maybe, if somebody asked. That sounds cool.
There are randomizers for like every cool old game. It's sick.
Yeah. I don't know. That might be fun to stream sometime. No, that is a fun game coming up with new ones. So much so that like that was the basis of about 95% of my play as a kid.
Mm. Yeah. You know? It's interesting the way that like that I think it's a generational thing because the Mavericks have always seemed less interesting to me because of the animal connection.
Uh-huh.
It always felt limiting. Like the idea that you had to have like a power element and then you just throw an animal in there. It felt like more like a formula than something like Dust Man.
Yeah.
You know, who's a man of trash. Like he deals with ducks and HVAC trash disposal and shit. Like, but it's just kind of shows you what like shows up as cool depending on how old you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, when I say it was the basis of 98% of my play, I am also including, like the, you know, blank, not blank man.
Yeah. I always include blank man.
Yeah. I always
include. He's been through enough. We have to make sure he has.
Yeah. No, but that includes original series kind of things too. Like I was going through old drawings, like literally from like kindergarten and first grade of me just inventing different kinds of men.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
It's like super fun. Like, and it was adjacent to making superheroes, which was like the thing I spent most of my time drawing as a kid, you know, when it was
Rewindo.
Great. Yeah. That kind of shit. The remote control, Clad Dagger, the Scarlet Bard, all kinds of shit that I made as a kid. I wish I still had those drawings. The fact that you have those is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty uncool that you still have your school papers, but it's very cool that you still have your drawings.
Hey, you know, I got rid of a lot of the old school papers.
Thank God.
I kept the draw. I went through all the drawings and kept the ones that I liked.
Good.
Yeah. What did the Scarlet Bard do?
He was based on the Red Mage from Final Fantasy.
Okay.
As a drawing. And he had the powers of basically the attack of Edward from Final Fantasy IV.
Okay.
He would play a harp and solid like projectile musical notes would come out.
Okay.
And shoot at people like physical notes.
Nice.
Yeah. It was fun.
The final X4 response, we have Diego who writes, I've been enjoying WoF for years, often moving back and forth from back catalog games I've loved to listening to the most recent episodes. Thank you for the hours of thoughtful conversations about games, from mechanics to creativity. Usually people save the nice stuff for the end.
Yeah.
Diego, you took it and you turned it.
You snuck it in.
Thank you for saying the nice things. On to Mega Man. I have so many memories of playing Mega Man from growing up, from Mega Man 2 as a young child to loving X1 and 2 on the SNES to chasing down a rental copy of X3 but never getting that far into it. When X4 came out on the PS1, I must have dropped everything to play and have nostalgia over playing through both campaigns. Have either of you chanced upon the fan-made 3D Mega Man X campaigns? The fan-made 3D Mega Man X demos. Watching some of them on YouTube, I can't help but think that Capcom is squandering an opportunity to bring an updated X out. Yes, there we go. An updated X out. Mega Man X Legends, maybe? Instead, there's the recently announced Dual Override, but I don't know if I need another 3D-ish Mega Man that looks like he's jumping through soup. Thoughts? And then continue to say some nice things. I know nothing about Mega Man X or Mega Man Dual Override. So
no, I cannot
comment on that. Yeah. I think that taking Mega Man X 3D would be just as problematic as taking regular Mega Man 3D. Like, Mega Man Legends only works because of its, you know, tone and art and stuff like that.
And its tone is completely different than Mega Man's.
Yeah.
Like, Mega Man Legends is only on paper a spinoff of Mega Man.
Yeah.
It's really a different thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a full third series.
Yeah.
I feel like.
I'm interested in the 3DX demo as a curiosity. But I don't think that it needs to be a 3D action game. I think they tried that with X7 and it largely was a real bummer.
Yeah. I like side scrolling games.
Yeah.
I think
it's fine for a game to be a side scroller.
Yeah. Yeah. For me.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. And the demos, that does sound interesting. Mm-hmm. Moving on to Mortal Kombat 2 responses. Brian says, listening to the episode brought back a memory of me and a friend trying to unlock naked mode during a sleepover. This has nothing to do with Mortal Kombat. You could just do it.
Yeah.
They're just different kinds of sleepovers. just kidding. I don't remember what it entailed, but the name Boobality jumps out at me. It's a powerful word.
It is. Yeah. No, I think during the episode, we remarked on how good of a word nudality is.
Yeah. Nudality.
a sensuality would be a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. what does the next person say?
Vivian says, Mortal Kombat 2 is a game that my brother absolutely trounced me at. In fact, he trounced me so hard that it put me off of the entire fighting game genre, which also happened to RTSs thanks to Tiberian's son. Anyway, I've healed now and learned all of Liu Kang's moves. So in like 30 years or whenever we're old, I'll be ready for a rematch.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Get the Genesis Mini at the nursing home. And
I love the idea of you nursing this grudge for years and years. And then just coming back to fucking stomping.
Bam.
Yeah.
Exotic Minivan says, I've never been big on fighting games, but Mortal Kombat 2 is probably one of my favorites. I like to play as Raiden because he has a hilarious looking move where he dives in the air across the screen. It's great because I started doing a thing when I play with friends where I announce the combo I'm going to do and then execute it. So every match turns into me yelling, back, back, forward, back, back, forward. Raiden starts diving, and because my friends aren't great at fighting games either, they never block it and I win every time. Always a great way to get some amazing laughs at the arcade.
So you're role-playing being some kind of cross between an anime protagonist and
like a
Parappa the Rapper.
Oh, sure.
Anime.
Yeah. Nice.
I like that. It got one of my favorite videos in that collection is watching them do that, like make that Raiden move.
I am on the chair.
Just with a rolling chair.
Yeah, rolling chairs. It's really good.
Yeah. Let's see here. Claire writes, Mortal Kombat as a series has aged strangely. As the games go on and the graphics and single-player story play a bigger role, the fatalities continue to be the big attraction to the detriment of both the devs and the story that they want to tell. It's so strange to watch a match that starts with Johnny Cage and his daughter exchanging a friendly dialogue before sparring, and ends with Johnny painting the floor with her face and parts of her skull. Yeah. For me, Mortal Kombat is best when it hits that Looney Tunes-ass silliness of the original trilogy, where Johnny Cage is just some Hollywood asshole doing a shoot and not a family annihilator.
Yeah, the congressional hearings about Family Annihilator were crazy.
That is some, like, as much as I liked the 2011 Mortal Kombat, which was like the first of them that I played that had like a campaign and story and like branching paths and stuff, that is a dissonance. Like, just you got all these people killing each other, and then we're just moving on to another part of the story.
Yeah, there's a line.
Yep.
You know, like there's a way that can be fun, you know, but it's definitely a thing that can be crossed.
Yeah.
Andre says, when I was 16, I got Mortal Kombat 2 on PC since my family didn't have a gaming console. I remember needing my mom's presence and spoken permission at the checkout counter at Best Buy to buy this M-rated game. Not embarrassing at all for someone with a driver's license. After that, my best friend and I played just about every day after school. We didn't have fight sticks, so he used the Gravis gamepad, which did not have enough buttons for Mortal Kombat, and I used the number pad on the keyboard. I still think I had the better deal. The PC version was great because it had even more rib cages and femurs than the home console version. Yeah. I know because later I played the SNES and was disappointed with the smaller bone pinatas. At the end of every session, we would finish with a best 2 of 3 scorpion battle. When my friend wasn't around, I played the single player and probably finished the game hundreds of times. The only reliable way I found to beat Kentaro and Shao Kahn was Katana's fan stasis thing, where she levitates the other character. It worked every time on both end bosses. Fantastic memories of an enjoyable episode from you both. Thank you very much.
Thanks. You, Andre. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, we didn't find a place to talk about this, but apparently the PC port of Mortal Kombat 2 is the best one.
Oh.
Like, you don't want to play with those shitty controllers, but in terms of, like, fidelity and accuracy to the arcade, it is the best one.
That tracks. It's not like a multi-screen thing. Yeah, I could see that. That Gravis gamepad is neat. I forgot that existed. It looks like just an SNES controller, but you can screw in a little joystick into the D-pad.
Yeah, Derek had that. I remember playing with that thing.
Yeah.
Moving on to Indiana Jones responses, which is kind of fun because we haven't recorded about it.
I know, right?
First for us. Sean says, the game really puts its best forward with the Vatican area. I was blown away by how the level felt like a real world location. However, as the game continued, the sheer scale of the levels wore me down and I started to rush to the end before my patience ran out. That's not to say that there was any major drop in quality, but it's a serious case of too much of a good thing.
That tracks.
Yeah, I think so too. I liked every bit of it. You know, there's no part of it I was like, this is bad. It's just, I was done with it.
It feels like ideally it would not have been trying to hit an hour count. And maybe you're hitting the upper limit of how good like a serialized pulp kind of story can be.
I think it's more the second. Hitting an hour count, because that would makes me think that there was some phoned in content, right? Like it was kind of filled in. It doesn't feel like that. Like there's nothing that felt phoned into me. It's just this story does not bear that weight.
Yeah.
It's like a whole season of an Indiana Jones TV show instead of an Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
Than anything. But it's the amount of like care that goes into even like later game areas and stuff is pretty impressive.
It's machine games. Like they're fucking great.
They're really, really good. No company hates Nazis as much as machine games.
Oh man.
It's great.
Yeah. Julia writes, there's a micro trend in big game studios trying to revitalize adventure action games by adding other mechanics. Indy adds immersive sim-adjacent costumes and interactions and stealth. Star Wars Outlaws adds stealth and a deep faction reputation mechanic to mixed success. Both downplay the action element. Are there other mechanics that you would like to see tried or let it die? Spoiler joke, shout out to Teen Todd Howard getting the idea for Raiders of the Lost Ark. No, the other one. It owns.
Cute. It's so weird to answer these before we've talked about the game.
I know, right?
Like at all, really. Like Indiana, Great Circle is really interesting because it's hard to pin it down to a genre at all. It's like a little bit of a lot of things.
Yeah.
I think that only succeeds if you have a really strong and kind of quick moving narrative.
Yeah.
Like you have to have a really charismatic presentation for that to work. Otherwise it's annoying because you just want to get back to the mechanic you like.
Yes.
You know, as a thing. So like in terms of wanting them added, I can't think of specific ones I would like added. It's more that I want them to be in certain games and let die for other games. Mm-hmm. If a game has a strong mechanical focus and that's the one thing it does well,
yeah.
I'd rather stick with that if it isn't something that is like a greater than the sum of its parts.
They can try any number of things. There needs to be integration. Like they need to play off of each other really well. Have something to hold them together. I would say even more so than presentation. If it is just the presentation, you're kind of on thin ice.
Yeah. In this, it's the presentation in that, or presentation, it's also subject matter in that like, these are all things Indiana Jones does.
Yes.
You know, if you were to take an Indiana Jones piece of media and boil it down to a genre, it wouldn't land in one genre. Mm-hmm. There's sitting down at tables and having tense conversations. There's archaeology work.
Yeah.
You know, there's navigation. There's all these things. It kind of has to be a chimera game.
Yeah.
For that to work.
This actually lends into Malachi's response pretty well, talking about doing Indiana Jones things.
which I'll read. Malachi says, "The Great Circle is a great example of what you spoke about on a recent dispatch, the fantasy. It is a fantastic yet flawed game that really let me sink into the role of Indiana Jones. I was curious how machine games would translate their experience with the Wolfenstein games into something much more stealth and puzzle focused, and they hit it out of the park. My only real gripe are the hubs and the bosses. While the Vatican hub feels great, the other two don't have the same feel. Gaza feels way too open and empty, and Sukhothai was just empty. The boss fights, mainly speaking of the Nephilim ones, rich me directly out of the fantasy, but I admit that it might just be a personal thing. My favorite tidbit from my time playing it was one night I was up late playing, really tired. An enemy spotted me while I was sneaking, and I just didn't really want to deal with it, so I took out my revolver for the first time in the game and just shot him. It wasn't until I was speaking with a coworker the next day that I realized how much I was emulating Jones."
It is so remarkable how they found a way to make the pistol exactly that in this game.
Yeah. I didn't shoot almost anything in the game.
Oh, no.
It's such a bad idea. I love that you have this whole set of weapons that they're not good to use.
Uh-huh.
They will fuck you over. In terms of fantasy, this is all previews of shit we're going to talk about next week. The fantasy in this game is strong enough that I think this is my favorite piece of Indiana Jones media.
Uh-huh.
With the caveat that I'm not a huge Indiana Jones guy.
Right.
Like the movies just fine, you know, like all the stuff. But yeah. I think this is the most I've liked Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
It is that strong in terms of doing the fantasy.
Yeah, I like Indiana Jones just fine as well. My enthusiasm for this kind of thing, like all of my little kid playtime kind of things when I wasn't designing Mega Man enemies, was like doing Indiana Jones adjacent stuff, right? And you get to do all that in this. So like the fact that this sings in the franchise because you just get to do that kind of stuff. I think it, you know, is the distinguishing factor here.
Smart.
Yeah.
Machine games kicks ass.
Yeah, they're so good. Doug writes, "For me, Indiana Jones is an IP that I hold very dear. One of my favorite childhood memories was going to see The Last Crusade with my dad. And when the film was given a limited theatrical re-release last Father's Day, I took my kids to see it. I vividly remember walking home from elementary school in second grade, humming the Raiders March the entire way home. There have been a handful of good games in the franchise, but The Great Circle was clearly aiming very high. Thankfully, the game delivered. I now put it in the same group as the Batman Arkham games and the Insomniac Spider-Man games as perfectly delivering on the promise of feeling what it is like to be a beloved character. In particular, Indy's endearing mix of panache and being more scrappy and improvisational in combat than having any finesse. Add in Troy Baker's pitch-perfect Harrison Ford impersonation, and this seems to be the best formula for continuing Indy's adventures now that Harrison has seemingly donned the fedora for the last time. Really looking forward to your coverage on this one."
We gotta let Harrison Ford rest.
We do.
He shouldn't have donned it the last time. Like, let that man die.
Yeah.
He's old.
He's so old. He does seem to have enthusiasm for Indiana Jones as a character.
Yeah, which is good. Like, I think he used to be kind of dismissive of his, like, pulp characters, but I think that was him, you know.
I think that is all memories of him talking about Han Solo. I only remember him, like, being just, like, super into Indy.
Yeah. Well, Han Solo is worse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Way worse.
100%.
Yeah, Star Wars sucks. The impersonation in this is fucking uncanny.
I don't know. I didn't even realize that Harrison Ford had a distinct way of speaking until I heard Troy Baker trying and fucking hitting it out of the park to realize, oh no, like he is tapping into something that like I wouldn't even begin to, like he is solving a problem I would not even begin to understand how to approach.
It's a real magic trick.
Yeah.
Like it's one of the finest impersonations period I've heard.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're glazing. Like this obviously has its problems and stuff. Really great game. Like, you know, next episode is not just going to be like an absolute glaze fest, but like that impersonation, I cannot imagine somebody having a problem with that. It is so goddamn good.
I came into it being ready to pick it apart. And I was like, no, actually, yeah, this fucking rules. No,
yeah, it's indistinguishable. I showed it to Liv and, you know, Liv's like, oh shit. Finally, Alex says, "I'm not much of an action game person, so I ended up watching my housemate play this game and occasionally offering helpful advice on puzzles and helpful advice in combat, like, you should really stop letting that guy hit you. But it became a fun thing to do together in our free time. The sheer joy involved in picking up random items and bonking fascists and Nazis with them as Indiana Jones, then hiding the bodies in the closest fascist pile, was something that we both have desperately needed and still do. I think my favorite moment was braining a fascist with what looked like a fly swatter and watching him fold like a cheap lawn chair. I also deeply appreciated how whiny and unhinged the unbossed Nazi became. You wouldn't think we'd so badly need a game to remind us how much Nazis suck in the 2020s, but well, here we are. True.
Yeah.
It was fun when we had consensus reality about Nazis.
I know, right? I just want to linger on the idea of a fascist pile.
Yeah. You get really good problem with the toileting in this while not having as developed stealth mechanics. Like, as far as I can tell, light doesn't matter.
Yeah.
In Indiana Jones, it's real weird. You can put not a fascist in a dark fascist pile and people can just spot it from a mile away. Mm-hmm. Very strange to play right after Thief 2. But
yeah.
I also made a pile. And then eventually I just stopped hiding bodies because, like, let them fear me.
Yeah.
Like, Batman reasons. Like, let them find the body. You get an achievement for killing a Nazi with a plunger or a toilet brush, rather.
Yay. Yeah,
it's real nice. Let's announce some games, then go eat respective lunches.
Yeah. Still weird to be synced up on the schedule like that. I need to open up that tab.
Have it open. I can pick it. So if you have responses about March's games, which are The Final Station and the only Traitor DLC, Donkey Kong Country 2, or Castlevania Bloodlines, the deadline is March 15th. duckfeed.tv/contact. The Final Station is real cool if you haven't played it. Like, I'd never heard of it before. It's neat. Yeah. And then for April, our games, you have until April 15th. And those games are Dead Space 2, We Love Katamari, Halo Wars, and Resident Evil Requiem.
Yeah, that was my pick. I wanted to strike while the iron was hot on that. I will, you know, obviously stream it. I want to talk with you about it, though, because I'm sure we're both going to have things to say. So wanted to get it in there as quick as we can.
Yeah, we do the new Resident Evil games as a premium episode when they come out.
Yeah.
That's kind of how we be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks everybody for listening. We appreciate you. If you would like to sponsor an episode, several of those are sponsored, the ones we've read. You can do so at patreon.com/duckfeedtv. You can also just support us and get our premium episodes, which will include Resident Evil Requiem, Castlevania Bloodlines, and a bunch of our other Resident Evil episodes, which are all bangers, according to people who listen to us.
Yeah. Yeah, and you get those by going to our Patreon, patreon.com/duckfeedtv, and you get a whole bunch of other bonus stuff. Since this is still a relatively new change, we double the amount of unfilmable you get. So if you like us talking about horror shit, that is where we do it now. Horror and feel bad things.
Yeah, primarily non-game media.
Yes.
Or exclusively non-game media. It'd be weird to do a Resident Evil game on that. That's not what we do.
Right.
So yeah, it's TV shows and movies. Mm-hmm. That's a really fun show to do, and I think those episodes are good as well. And you get the back catalog, of course. Mm-hmm. You can also leave us ranged reviews on Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, tell your friends, write about us on message boards, things like that. If you're in the Patreon, you can join the Discord. Mm-hmm. The Discord now. Yeah. You can join. What else? Gwen.
Big thanks to Gwen. Yeah. There's Gwen to thank.
Yeah. We got Gwen to thank.
Oh, and I want to say, so when we read people's questions, like the Q&A mm-hmm. portion of this, those are submitted as replies on Patreon to our call for responses there. Some of those people send them in through email. I do not know if you're a patron, and I do mm-hmm. not, because that is a perk, I kind of don't include those. Game responses go to duckfeed.tv/contact. But if you have a question or answer, join the Patreon and look for the prompt post.
Yes. Yeah, that's how you do it. And mm-hmm. We'd appreciate it. We never talk about this. Once a quarter, rather, we put out a bonus one of these.
Yeah.
With all of our overflow questions. Those are really fun. So if you're thinking, like, oh, your question didn't get answered, it might be there.
Mm-hmm.